This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The television version of this show airs on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Donald Trump would like all Americans to believe that every Muslim person is a member of ISIS in waiting, ready to commit heinous acts of homegrown terrorism against innocent people. His call to ban all Muslims in the U.S. has already had real-world impacts, as it emboldens nascent Islamophobia and normalizes hateful rhetoric. Well, the best antidote to this latest anti-Muslim chapter in the U.S. are the voices of Muslim Americans themselves. Among them is my guest, the founder and editor-in-chief of MuslimGirl.com, the top Muslim women's blog in the U.S. Amani Al-Khattatba has just written a book. It's called Muslim Girl, A Coming of Age. She now joins me on the show. Welcome, Amani.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, tell us how your blog, which was the sort of pathway to you gaining this public voice and eventually writing this book, how it all started. In going through your blog, it's a remarkable sort of online documentation of the incredible diversity of Muslim young women and the various issues that are important to you. How did you get it all started?
I started it out of my bedroom when I was a teenage girl, and it started out of my personal frustration with the way that Muslim women were being excluded from the conversation. Growing up, especially after 9/11, which took place when I was 9 years old, it was like I never saw anyone that looked like me in the news, even though all they were talking about was women like me. And I thought that was really wrong, and I felt like it just perpetuated a lot of inaccurate information about who we are and what we stand for. So honestly, Muslim Girl started because I was going through so much adversity and feeling so much alienation as a result of this, that I wanted to find other young Muslim girls that were just like me, that were my age, that were young when 9/11 happened, that were experiencing bullying in school like I was, that felt this type of detachment and this type of divide. And so I started a place online for all of us to find each other and have the conversations we wanted to have amongst each other, in the hopes that we could cultivate a strong voice for ourselves.
And so 9/11 was a turning point for you, the sort of before and after. You were only 9 years old. You were living in New Jersey. I know for myself, it was a turning point as well for different reasons. For a lot of folks who remember that time, who are either young adults or adults, remember that there being a sort of before 9/11 and an after 9/11. But how typical was your experience after you started the blog? Did you realize that what you went through and in seeing September 11th as a turning point was a fairly common experience for a lot of Muslim teens?
I suspected as much, but of course I wasn't really sure, but I felt like they had to have been feeling many of the similar things that I was feeling and that I was experiencing. 9/11 was definitely a turning point in my life. You know, it happened so early on that it's all I can remember now is just being indoctrinated into this culture of anti-Muslim bigotry. Especially because I was in elementary school. So it happened during such a sensitive time in my growth as a child, and going through the height of Islamophobia during my years of puberty, my coming of age, I think really formed and shaped who I am. I write in the book that on the day of 9/11, I felt the earth shift on its axis that day. And my dad actually, like one of the earliest memories that I remember of that day was when we were all sitting in my family's living room and we're watching the footage loop over and over again of the Twin Towers and the planes crashing into them. And my father looked at us and he said, "This, it's going to get much worse. They're going to blame us for this and it's going to get much, much worse." And he had that foresight where he knew that, you know, Muslims would be scapegoated for this and it would impact our lives in a way that we could not have predicted. It definitely was a huge marker, a huge turning point. And I also think that it has been a defining experience for many Muslim millennials.
Now, can you give us some examples of the kinds of bullying you experienced? We know today, for example, that the Islamophobia is actually much worse than it was in the months and years immediately following 9/11. The Council on American Islamic Relations have done studies. School bullying for Muslim kids is a big problem. And you write in your book about some of the experiences you had, which for a young person, bullying is always extremely traumatic. But I don't think we hear enough in our mainstream discourse about the kinds of bullying Muslim kids face simply for being Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, really, the thing that I like to remind people is that my book is a story of one of the most privileged experiences of Muslim women and Muslim girls growing up after 9/11. My experience is just one of many, and there are much, much worse things that have been experienced as a result of anti-Muslim bigotry than even what I detail. But one of the stories that I wrote about in the book very early on, and that I think has resonated with a lot of people, was the experience of hearing my first racial slur when I was in elementary school. And unfortunately, you're right, things are still very bad. Possibly where I really don't want to say that they're worse than right after 9/11, because that scares me to think that it's getting worse rather than, being just as bad or something like that. But I just a couple of months ago, I was speaking at the national meeting of the Muslim Youth of North America. And it was a crowd of very young kids. They were all students. They were all in high school or much younger than that. And I asked the room, how many children in here have been called a racial slur? And at least a third of the room's hands shot up. And it was really, really terrifying for me. I was like, oh my God, this is still something so pervasive. It happened to me when I was in fourth grade, but many of these kids are even younger than that. One girl that was sitting in the front row, she couldn't have been older than 7 years old. She didn't even know what racial slur meant. And she asked me, she said, what is that? And when I explained to her what a racial slur was, then she raised her hand too. So it really is very heartbreaking. Bullying is just one of the many ways that Islamophobia has been impacting our lives. Just a few weeks ago, a young Muslim boy committed suicide. He hung himself after going home to his mother and telling him about the extreme bullying that he was experiencing in his school right here in the United States. So this is an issue that we obviously have to address.
You write in your book that after 9/11, quote, our beautiful house in the calm New Jersey suburbs was egged, water ballooned, and teepeed. So it wasn't just you in school, it was your whole family in the community.
Yeah, it was my whole family and it was the whole community. Like our mosques obviously were being vandalized. My family's house was definitely targeted in our neighborhood. I attended a high school of 3,000 kids. I was one of only a handful of Arab Muslim students in the entire school district. And because of that, I think that, that elicited a strong response from our community. But yeah, that's really the tip of the iceberg with what my family had to endure. More further on in the book, I talk about how my father, he had a store in the flea market in our hometown. And right after 9/11, one of the vendors started a petition to the flea market management demanding that all Muslim vendors in the building and their businesses be evicted. And that was something that they had to endure, that type of harassment of people literally coming to their store and calling them names, their tires being slashed, them being even accused of terrorism and things like that. It was very terrifying. And of course, right after 9/11, with all the hysteria, especially, like what we see today with the refugee crisis and things like that, it's during those times that minorities are the most vulnerable, and that we are the most exposed. And, we even see like law enforcement be used as a weapon against us. We see our rights be taken away from us, like through the Patriot Act that targets Muslim communities with unlawful surveillance solely because of their religious background. So it's definitely still an ongoing thing, and it's all within the context of the war on terror, unfortunately.
Tell me about your trip to Jordan. You were a teenager when you traveled back to, I believe it was your father's homeland.
Yeah, my father's originally from Jordan, and I moved there when I was 13 years old with my family. And I didn't realize it until I started writing this book that my father actually made that decision because he felt like he needed to protect our family from Islamophobia. At the time as a child, you know, I didn't really realize all the things that my family or my parents were shielding me from, actually until I started writing this book and I started interviewing them for it. And I started recalling like all of these things that they were going through at the time. But we moved to Jordan for a little less than a year. And that was the first time in my life that I lived within a Muslim community, you know, like within a country that exercised and practiced Islam. And it's
you weren't a minority, like, but actually part of a community where everybody was like you.
Yeah, and I got to see firsthand, you know, what Islam really was, separate from the way that it was being misconstrued here in the West. And I saw with my own eyes just how different reality was from the way that it was being portrayed, you know, like on the news headlines in my home in New Jersey. And that's why, you know, I just made the mental connection where, okay, when I get back to America, I have to make this known, you know, I have to make a difference somehow. To bridge that gap. And it was a very eye-opening experience for me.
Now, you made the decision early on to wear a headscarf, and it's something that you write about in your book, that your mother doesn't wear it. You made a conscious decision. Nobody in your family pressured you. And this is a really important issue because I think a lot of Americans have a terrible misconception. Even liberal, well-meaning Americans have this conception that all Muslim girls who wear a hijab or wear a headscarf do so because they're being pressured to, forced to, coerced to by their families and or by their communities. But that's not always the case. It might be the case in some cases, but it's not always that women are forced to do it. And often, especially here in the U.S., where, you know, we do have more freedoms, where it's not something mandated by a government, it's a very conscious choice. Can you tell us a little bit about that choice and why it was important for you?
My choice in wearing a headscarf was a very personal one that stemmed from my defiance of Islamophobia and my reclamation of my identity in the face of Islamophobia. I wanted this to be my defiance, that even in the face of this extreme adversity, that I chose to identify myself as a Muslim in spite of that. And it comes internally from a very deep place of rejecting this patriarchy that we've been indoctrinated into, especially in Western societies. You know, I wear it to reject the same governments that force women to wear a headscarf as the ones that force women to take it off or to not cover up in public, for example, like we saw with the French ban against the burkini this summer. Both are the same issue to me, which is controlling the way a woman chooses to dress or express herself in the public space. And for me, all my life, I felt like I was being controlled or I was being pressured to conform a certain way and push myself away from my Muslim identity in public.
And when you say pressured, not by your family, but you mean by American society?
By society, mm-hmm. By society and by the media, by misrepresentation, by all of the crazy headlines inundating me with all this mixed messaging about who Muslims are, what they stand for, what Islam is really all about, that were obviously very inaccurate. And for me, this was my way of taking that back. And it presented me with, I didn't realize it, but eventually it offered me a really great opportunity to do just that. Because when I did come back to New Jersey, many people who might not have even known that I was a Muslim before then that went to my school, suddenly, because they were familiar with me and suddenly identified me as a Muslim, they started coming to me with their questions about Islam or the things they were hearing about the news or about what the headscarf means. From students to even teachers who would have questions about my religion that they would pose to me. And because of that, you know, I started researching Islam even more because I told myself, oh my God, I have to know the answer so I can respond to these people and give them some accurate information. So I started researching Islam like very thoroughly. And I think that that process is what led to me eventually creating a space called Muslim Girls and you know, finding a place where many people can connect to ask those questions, communicate, and also to share that information.
And so in a way, it sounds like it's been freeing for you, but also added responsibilities to you. Do you find yourself sort of having to resist this notion that you're now the poster child for Islam?
Of course, every day. And I think that's the case with a lot of members of minority communities, right? It's like when we're on the front lines, our presence is immediately tokenized. And that's why I always, every opportunity I get, I try to remind people, you know, whether it's myself in person or in different parts throughout the book that you'd see while you're reading it, that I try to remind anyone hearing my story that this really is one of the most privileged experiences. You know, like it's palatable, it's digestible, it's something that people can swallow. And I just so happen to be in a very opportune position where I'm able to translate that for people that might not otherwise understand it. But I think it's very important for us to also remember, you know, the Muslim women that are the recipients of our war on terror, that are on the receiving end of it, that have endured such extreme violence and irreversible damage as a result of our failed foreign policy because of the way that we've misrepresented Muslim women in the media here at home. By extension, it's caused a lot of pain and suffering for a lot of people who did not deserve it. And I think that's where the root of what we're doing is. It comes from changing public perception and creating a strong voice for us so that people can't say that Muslim women are oppressed and we need to liberate them, or they can't speak for themselves and we have to speak for them. But rather, no, we do have our own voice, and this is the way that you are affecting us. I think that's really important.
Well, finally, what do you hope for your story in your book and even your blog, MuslimGirl.com, to achieve? It seems as though stories like yours and the blog and the space that you've created can be a very positive and empowering space for Muslim teens, girls who might be struggling to find out where they fit within American society, a society that otherizes them. And, you know, with people like Donald Trump in particular, demonizes them.
Our hope is to develop Muslim Girl into a sustainable flagship for the Muslim American community. It's always been my dream to create an institution that Muslim women can count on and that will always be there for them. And, you know, we're in a moment right now where Muslim women are a hot topic. We're being spoken about in the news a lot. We're making headlines. Our imagery is being used in campaigns and whatnot to show diversity. And it's my prerogative to take this, what could possibly be just a brief moment in the spotlight, and turn it into something long lasting and empowering for us rather than exploitative of us. And really, we're not going to stop until we become the first mainstream media network by and for Muslim women. That's the goal.
And it's so interesting, and going through your website, the diversity of Muslim women's voices is pretty remarkable. You have an article just recently published about why Planned Parenthood is critical for Muslim women. Another personal account of a woman taking off her hijab. And so I just think that's something that also defies stereotypes, that we think of Muslims as this monolithic group, but you can be a Muslim who doesn't wear a hijab. You can be a Muslim, you know, in so many different ways. It's about self-identification, right? And for some, being Muslim is also a cultural identification, even not even necessarily a purely religious one, right?
Absolutely. And that's exactly it. That's probably the most important thing for us to push back against is that we are a monolith, that we're one homogenous group. When we try to group an entire population of people as one entity, that's how we successfully dehumanize them. And by showcasing how diverse Muslim women are and perpetuating the truth that Muslim women come from literally every walk of life imaginable, that's how we're able to reclaim that and really push forward stories that remind people that we're human beings.
Well, Amani, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you with the book and the website.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
My guest is Amani Al-Khattatba. She is the founder and editor-in-chief of MuslimGirl.com. We've been talking to her about her new book, simply entitled Muslim Girl, A Coming of Age. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RU with Sonali.